Thanks, Don. Thank you all for coming today. It is going to be different. It dawned on me that it's probably going to be distinctly different from what we've been hearing relative to you're hearing from a climate scientist first and foremost. So I hope I don't bury you in data, but I did tackle this topic, though, a little bit more broadly, geographically, so I hope I'm not going to be too Minnesota-centric, because the Upper Mississippi Basin encompasses a lot of landscape. And so I'm going to try to tailor some comments relative to that and the disparity across that landscape. Fundamental premise for me, or takeaway for you to talk about over a cup of coffee or a cocktail tonight, is that in the context of everything we're talking about at this session, I humbly submit to you that the climate change fingerprint on all this is still underestimated. That's my thesis. So we'll go through this. I've broken, as is my custom, I've broken my remarks down into segments. First off, I'd like to present a few information sources. I know from looking at several familiar faces here that some of you are already quite familiar with these resources, but since we're streaming live and goodness knows who's going to look at this, we'll provide some general background here as well. Then I'm going to talk about temporal and spatial context. I think that's very important. Changing climate attributes or evidence, and that's where the data pieces come in. Extremes, as Maggie already alluded to, and several others that gave presentations today about the episodic nature of behavior on the landscape. Extremes are obviously really, really important, and the facts that for some extremes our amplitude and frequencies are changing climatically, that is really important. And then lastly, talk about associated consequences and implications. So from the standpoint of resources, the last year's National Climatic Assessment and the regionalization of the National Climatic Assessment by many, many renowned scientists serves us, continuing today, serves us with very good resource data for what's happening regionally with respect to the Upper Mississippi Basin relative to climate change and its associated consequences. It's still called on by many researchers and many of those in state and federal government agencies as a resource. I think it's set a very high bar for future such productions, but I know that our agencies are going to continue to do that and do this type of work periodically, so I look forward to reading the next national assessment as well. NOAA resources, our colleagues at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration continue to put out very pertinent, useful data sets as well as analysis of those data sets, and I trust that many of you in the room are quite well aware of the climate.gov as a web resource. The American Association of State Climatologists, which, by the way, was just highly organized last year, hired their first executive director, and they too, as an organization, have been putting out a lot more climate and climate change data sets and analyses, and many of which now will be much more oriented to agricultural production systems. The IPCC, which I don't know if that's been mentioned yet. Of course, we have the negotiations coming up later this month on the first week of December in Paris, and the periodic assessments of the IPCC scientists are still very valued research. I think we'll hear even more from them relative to downscaling and the from the modeling perspective, what the downscaled model output says about agriculture and water resource management. And then from my own perspective, the second edition of the Minnesota Weather Almanac, which was released earlier this year by Minnesota Historical Society Press, For those of you from outside Minnesota, that's kind of our Minnesota weather history book, and that's taken 8 of my 37 years to write. And that has every significant event and episode in Minnesota from 1807 to 2014. There's the geographic context for my remarks. That's the Upper Mississippi Basin on the map that you see there. Some of the climate extremes that we've associated in the climate science community with those include some remarkable amounts of precipitation, excuse me, framed anywhere from minutes to hours to days, weeks, months, years, etc. Snow, and that was alluded to earlier. We live in a landscape periodically visited by heavy snow deposition. When heavy snow deposition does come, it invariably affects the Upper Mississippi Basin. I'll say more about that later. We also live on a landscape over the course of decades that's seen a lengthening of the growing season, and with an associated lengthening of the growing season, we've seen expansion of crop varieties to many landscapes that they formerly were unsuitable for or were not used with much frequency. We've seen a change in cropping practices and rotations and a variety of other things. Another detail that nevertheless relates to agricultural production systems, albeit mainly livestock production systems, but is a change in the frequency and amplitude of the heat indexes that encompass this particular part of the American landscape. And I can show you some examples of those as well. But that's just, the intent here isn't to be comprehensive, but the intent is to just show a few examples of the amplitude and range of extremes that the climate system can deliver to this particular landscape. We have wonderful resources. I think that's already been alluded to by a number of speakers today. We, on the Upper Mississippi Basin, have a tremendous research database associated with a gauged volume flow on this watershed. Some of these data sets go back to the 19th century. Many of them go back to the early 20th century. Gauged volume flow relates very, very much to a climate signature. It's been used as such for many different purposes. We need to differentiate, though, here as we look at the Upper Mississippi. We need to be very careful about differentiating the effects relative to seasonality. We are subject to tremendous, tremendous flooding potential from spring snowmelt events. Spring snowmelt events are well forecasted now by our weather service, so we have ample opportunity to prepare for them, but they're long duration events, tend to be long duration events, and they tend to delay or otherwise disrupt the agricultural season depending on what time of the spring that they occur and how long they last. I would remind you, not in the Upper Mississippi Basin, but I would remind you in the Red River Valley Basin, that back in 2009 we had a remarkable spring snowmelt flood event that ran for 66 consecutive days in the Fargo-Moorhead area, shattering all previous records by a mile for the longest duration flood in that region of the landscape. As opposed to the other type that we all know so well, which of course is the flash flood scenario, the convective, usually thunderstorm-generated, high-volume event that will produce a flash flood and be very, very devastating to the landscape. Very damaging from the standpoint of agricultural sediment loads, soil erosion, crop damage, you name it, and that we are not, even today's date, even at this point in time with the deployment of all of the technology that we have at our disposal, we are not necessarily very good at forecasting. some quick samples of the Upper Mississippi Basin, and I would simply like you to note the years, because I'm going to be talking about trends in a few minutes. I'm going to show you the top 10 flood crests associated with various points on the Upper Mississippi Basin. These, again, to remind you, are based on histories of volume flow measurements that go back to the early 20th century and in some cases even the 19th century. Please note the dates and years. Some are associated with spring snowmelt flood events and some are associated with summertime convective events. You can see downtown St. Paul as the river flows through downtown St. Paul in this list. You can look further downstream at Genoa, Wisconsin, and look at some of the top 10 events that have occurred there along the Mississippi Basin. You can go on down to Dubuque and look at those that have impacted the Dubuque area of the Mississippi. And go on down to Rock Island, Illinois, and again see some of the all-time flood crests that have gone through Rock Island, Illinois. And then St. Louis, Missouri, and we all remember 1993, those of us that lived through 1993, how unforgettable that was in terms of probably for many still, the wettest year of climate record for many climate stations in the Upper Mississippi Basin. And for a vast majority of climate stations on the Upper Mississippi, the singular wettest summer in climate history from 1993. And then Chester, Missouri, down on the end of the Upper Mississippi Basin, and again you can see some of the recent years associated with that. So in our region, most of my recent talks in the last several years have focused on these three climate attributes, temperature, moisture, and water vapor. It's not singularly Mark Seely's message. This is a message that is really common for most of the climate scientists that work in our region. As we have dissected the data and analyzed the historic data of these attributes from all the states in the region, we see significant trends coming in play. And we are all in agreement that these attributes are all already having impact or consequence to our natural resources and our infrastructure. For context, to lead into the temperature discussion I have, I just wanted to point out, by any measure, the year 2015 is probably going to go into the record books as the warmest year globally. I think we've all seen the headlines about that already this year. This is a global depiction of the temperature anomaly for the first 9 months. I would remind you that one of the real anomalies in Minnesota in the year 2015 was that September was our warmest September in state history. Just 2 months ago, the month of September was our warmest September in Minnesota state history. I would also remind you that October continued that trend, although it was not record-setting. October 11th of last month, we had 97 degrees at Sabin, Minnesota, up in Clay County, which shattered the all-time record for the highest ever measured temperature on the Minnesota landscape in the month of October. It was equivalent to Phoenix, Arizona on that date. Also, by the NASA analysis, we also see that the year 2015 is tracking so far to be the warmest of the 1880 to present period. There is disparity across the signature of the temperature so far this year in our U.S. landscape. As you can see from the color-coded depiction here from the NOAA analysis, the first 9 months in the western states have been the hottest of record. We've all been hearing about that. We know what level of drought has plagued them for many years now, as well as the wildfire season that plagued them this year. But we see even here in the Midwest, we look at the high plains states in the Midwest, We're definitely having a warm year, although not record-setting. It's ranked fairly high in the historic distribution. To analyze that, we have a number of long-term data sets. Many of these data sets that we use for calculating the normals or the reference averages community by community on the upper Mississippi Basin go back well over 50 years, and I might further add a number of them go back well over 100 years of records, so they too provide a tremendous resource for us to analyze. And using that resource, we find disparity in the temperature change as we look at the different parts of our country. It's important to note that we see quite a lot of disparity in the temperature signal change, even as we look at a geographic area the size of the Upper Mississippi Basin. So if you look, for example, at the color-coded map in front of you here, you'll see that over Minnesota, which is shaded in a lot of pinks and reds, we're seeing a more amplified temperature change than, say, as you progress down the Mississippi Valley through Iowa and Illinois through Missouri, where you see a suppressed temperature signal change, or in fact you see no signature temperature change down in those landscapes. And this comes out when we look at the data state by state. In the state of Iowa, the NOAA analysis of the statewide data for Iowa show a net change in the Iowa state mean annual temperature value of only about 1 degree per century. In Illinois, likewise, we see about 1 degree change per century. Missouri, we don't even see 1 degree. It's less than 1 degree change across time in the mean annual temperature in the state of Missouri. But as we climb to the higher, a little bit higher latitude positions, and we look at Wisconsin, we see a 2 degree change in the mean annual temperature in Wisconsin, and we see a 2 degree change in the mean annual temperature in Minnesota across time. We also see some disparity in the seasonality in terms of the degree of change with seasonality. We see that winter has a rather pronounced change compared to some of the other seasons of the year. If we dissect normals, and we do this station by station, as I said, we have hundreds of stations that we can do this. We look at the net change at a point along the Mississippi Basin like St. Cloud. We see it's prolifically positive. This is net change when we transferred our frame of reference from 1971 to 2000, and we now use 1981 to 2010. It's prolifically a positive net change month by month, with some disparity between months, as well as some disparity between the net change in minimum versus the net change in maximum. And then we step down to Moline, Illinois, and again we see what the net change in normal temperature normals has been in a place along the Mississippi like Moline. Again, we see pretty a majority of positive change, some of it more than 1 degree. But by the time we get down to Hannibal, Missouri, we see that the net change in normals was kind of mixed, between negative change, positive change, and no change down in that part of the Upper Mississippi Basin. So we have to acknowledge that for this particular watershed that we're concentrating our discussion on relative to American agriculture, that we're seeing some disparity in the rate of change of temperature as we step from higher latitude position to lower latitude position on the Mississippi Basin. Seasonality, though, is very distinct, especially up in the headwaters region of this watershed. So for Minnesota, if we look at the net change across time in average winter minimum temperature, so we just take the months of December, January, and February, and we simply take the element of minimum temperature as opposed to maximum temperature, we see a net change of about 4.5 degrees per century on the Minnesota landscape, which is, from a statistical standpoint, a pretty appreciable change. Similarly, in Wisconsin, we look at the Wisconsin minimum temperature change for the winter season, and we see a net change of 3 degrees in the average winter minimum temperatures. In fact, in our region, what we see in terms of pace of change, we see that the minimum temperatures month by month across the year are changing at roughly twice the pace of the maximum temperature. This is true for Wisconsin, this is true for Minnesota, and we've also looked at it for Manitoba and Ontario. And so generally in the Western Great Lakes region, we see this signature change that the rate of change in the minimum temperature is about twice the rate of change in the maximum temperature. Water vapor, a couple quick comments about that. Our Canadian friends have studied this a lot more than any other group I know, and also some of the IPCC scientists. And we are seeing a water vapor feature that in the Northern Hemisphere may be manifested by a change in oceanic temperature. We all know we've been hearing about the very amplified, strong El Nino episode in the equatorial Pacific this year, but we also need to acknowledge that the North Pacific Ocean, portions of the North Pacific Ocean, are warmer this year than in any of the previous 40 years. And so as oceanic temperatures warm, they give up more water vapor into the overlying atmosphere, which increases the water vapor content. That is, however, a very complex signal when we look at oceans versus land. The complex signal is being looked at isotopically from the standpoint of the isotopic composition of that water vapor. Researchers are getting closer to understanding the sources of that water vapor, whether they're terrestrial in nature due to evapotranspiration changes, or whether they're oceanic in nature due to changing ocean temperature. But nevertheless, the point being, in recent decades, we're seeing a larger volume of water vapor present in much of our atmosphere. This translates in some of the individual station records to the episodic nature of highly amplified dew point conditions, which we've been plagued by very, very much in the last 3 decades. By definition, an air mass with a dew point of 70 degrees or higher is a tropical air mass. We use the word tropical associated with that air mass. We have had many, many more episodes of such air masses in the upper Mississippi Basin in recent decades that have produced very, very uncomfortable summertime conditions. In fact, having studied Minnesota's climate so intently, I can tell you that a dew point measurement in the Minnesota landscape, anywhere in the Minnesota landscape, that produced an 80-degree dew point reading was nowhere in existence until 1983. In the summer of 1983, we observed our first ever 80-degree dew point on the Minnesota landscape, and since then, we've actually seen a real increase in frequency for that level of water vapor. That level of water vapor grossly inflates the heat index. The heat index is a combination of the water vapor and temperature and its effect on our human physiology. By law, the Weather Service in our neck of the woods up here in Minnesota has to issue a heat advisory to the public if the heat index is ever going to go to 100 or higher. And by retroanalysis of the historic data, we're in a period of time right now where they're having to issue more and more frequent heat advisories, the Weather Service, because of this change in this atmospheric element, this water vapor content. We've had a whole run of summers where they've had to issue heat advisories because the dew points have inflated the heat index to values as high as 134 degrees, which we had on July 19th, 2011 at Moorhead, Minnesota, with an air temperature of 95 and a dew point of 88 degrees. So we had an outdoor environment present in the Minnesota landscape that was equivalent to walking into the gymnasium sauna. And that is very disturbing to see the stress of that level present here in Minnesota. This is what the excessive heat warning looked like that day, and this is a simple list of the community records that were set that day across the region for highest measured heat index value. And these are astonishing. Having been in atmospheric and climate science for about 40 years, I would have never anticipated seeing this. And it really makes for some disconcerting thoughts about where we might be going in the future. Water vapor. Water vapor also relates to the precipitation we get. They're coupled, if you will, in terms of the climatic conditions. A high water vapor in the atmosphere naturally tends to produce high levels of precipitation. So yesterday, for example, I would remind you that the radiosonde measurement over the state of Minnesota yesterday, the instrumented balloon that went up at 6 o'clock in the morning, measured 1.18 inches of precipitable water in the vertical column of atmosphere over Minnesota, which was the second highest water vapor measurement in the atmosphere over us in the month of November in history. And what did we get yesterday? We got a record-setting rainfall. We got a record-setting rainfall right here, right where you're hosting this meeting. Got a record-setting rainfall yesterday. So we look at the distribution of rainfall change across this country, and we see up and down the upper Mississippi basin, we see a lot of green coloration. And the green coloration on the map here is an increase in overall precipitation that's occurred over this part of the American landscape. We do see other areas around where there's been no net change, or we even see the light yellow and brown areas where there's been a net negative change. But on the upper Mississippi basin, it's prolifically positive relative to the precipitation change. Here's where we are so far this year. Been a very, very wet year, record-setting year, as we know, in the southern plains states. Very wet in the midsection. We're still in the wetter part of the historical distribution as a state, as you can see from this distribution. That's how 2015's been going. Here's a quick snapshot of state-by-state depiction for the upper Mississippi basin. So we see an upward trend in the Iowa historical data that amounts to 3.6 inches per annum or on an annual basis over a century. In Illinois, we see 3.9 inches over a century. Missouri, about 2 inches. Wisconsin, 2.4 inches. Minnesota, 2.5 inches. So as a composite, we factor in all the climate stations from all of those states. Those are the upward progressions that we see in mean annual precipitation state by state in the upper Mississippi basin. We do see some seasonality disparity in the track or trend line through those. Winter is very, very modest. Spring is more steeply upward. Summer is a little bit more modest, and autumn is distinctly upward in our own Minnesota data series. We have, like we've seen the changes in the temperature normals come into play, we have seen the changes in the annual precipitation normals come into play. So at Brainerd, again a little closer to the headwaters of the Mississippi Basin, we've seen a 23% increase over time in what we call normal there. Down at Cedar Rapids, Iowa, we've seen a 17% increase in what we call normal, that part of the Mississippi Basin. Over at Galena, we've seen a 16% change in the Normal there at Galena, Illinois. But the other thing that's important, especially if we want to relate climate change and the element of precipitation to agriculture, is we need to think a little bit more carefully than just quantity. We need to think about the type of precipitation that's occurring, because we are, as I already said earlier, in a landscape that can have frozen or liquid precipitation. Intensity, how fast does it come? How frequently does it come? With what duration? And are there seasonal shifts? And so we need to think, as researchers that are trying to add to the knowledge base that we can use for managing our agriculture better, we need to think about those other attributes of precipitation besides just quantity. In terms of frequency, there's been some modest, and I might further add, non-statistically significant changes. But if we want to look at frequency of precipitation, this is a dissection of some of the points along the basin. Dubuque has seen an increase of averaging about 112 days a year with measurable precipitation to 120. Moline, Illinois, averaged formerly about 112 days per year of annual precipitation up to 119. Locally here in the Twin Cities, we've gone from about 110 up to 117. Southern Minnesota, a little bit more. Waseca's gone from 97 to 119. Hannibal, Missouri has been up and down, but it's definitely higher now than it, most other periods in history. And La Crosse, Wisconsin is a little bit higher. But like I said, these are just trends. I'm not putting statistical significance tied to these, but that's what the frequency of such events looks like across time. More importantly is the intensity measurement. How often do we get a certain level of intensity in the precipitation measurement? And many people, many, many famous, well-known scientists have studied this. Ken Kunkel, Kevin Trenberth, Tom Carl, and a whole bunch of others, and have dissected the national data, and particularly for the Midwest, showing that the more intense events, the 2-inch rain, the 3-inch rain, the 4-inch rain, are occurring with higher frequency. They're occurring in the modern era with higher frequency than they did in history. And this is a depiction of the Western Great Lakes region, which has seen a whole-scale change in the frequency of very heavy events. Those show up in a variety of ways. It shows up, those of you that have looked at the NOAA Atlas 14 frequency analysis for precipitation that just came out for the region a few years ago have probably noticed this, but we have seen almost a doubling of some of the frequencies, so that the 2-inch thunderstorm rainfall at many locations along the upper Mississippi basin now has essentially doubled. Now that generally produces, as we know, especially in any kind of landscape that has any slope to it, generally produces a major runoff event with a good deal of erosion when we have a rainfall intensity of that magnitude or greater. And yet seeing something like that double, and seeing some individual extreme events that have gone up to 13 to 18 inches in 24 hours is absolutely remarkable. We've also seen, because the nature of those events is convective thunderstorm generation, the nature of the convective thunderstorm generation is all about a geographic disparity. It's all about where the thunderstorm affects on the landscape and where it misses. And oftentimes those places are right next to each other. And so when we get precipitation of this character, real intense thunderstorms, especially if they train along a weather frontal boundary that's stationary, then we get huge disparity. And someone may get on one side, may get several inches, and someone on the other side of the boundary will get entirely missed. So what this leads to is abundance and deficiency. And the abundance and deficiency in extreme becomes flood and drought. And the character of this was manifest in the display in front of you here for the year 2012, which in Minnesota's history we call a singularity. We call 2012 a singularity. Regionally and within Minnesota in 2012, we had the worst drought since 1988. We had 57 of our Minnesota counties declared by USDA to be drought disasters, and they fell in the severe to extreme drought category. All the symptoms of drought were in play in those counties, and citizens of those counties were eligible for federal assistance because of a drought declaration. Embedded in that and embedded on the map is also, you can see a plus sign embedded in some of those counties, and they were simultaneously declared by FEMA to be in flood disaster and eligible for federal assistance for flood disaster. So in some individual counties in the state of Minnesota, we had federal declarations in play at the same moment in time for polar opposite weather disasters. That's never happened before in Minnesota history, but it is symptomatic of climate behavior that is becoming highly variable, highly erratic, very extreme, and very different from what we've experienced in the past. One final thing about this that's very important. Many of you know that we've had Dr. Harold Brooks from the Severe Storms Lab in Oklahoma to speak in Minnesota each of the last 6 years. Dr. Brooks is one of the nation's leading researchers on severe weather. He studies the upper atmosphere and the conditions in the upper atmosphere that produce severe convective weather, the severe thunderstorm rains, the hail, the straight line winds, tornadoes, and a number of other things. And Dr. Brooks' research with each passing year, his published research is finding that the severe weather elements in the air over us are becoming more frequent in nature, so that over southern Minnesota and Iowa today, we have a frequency of severe thunderstorm development that is more analogous to what they had in Oklahoma and Kansas decades ago. He measures this with what he calls ingredients methods. He dissects the radiosonde data, the instrumented balloon data that go up every 12 hours, and he looks at the precipitable water, which I've already alluded to earlier. He dissects the instability indices, like the CAPE, the convectively available potential energy. There's a whole bunch of others. And he dissects, and then he goes through and trends these across time. And what he's finding is the disturbing trends in these elements are increasing in frequency with latitude. And he finds this all to be the case all over the world, but if you look at the Midwest, we definitely see a latitude shift in those elements. For example, if we take the all soundings from Lincoln, Illinois, from the Upper Air Station at Lincoln, Illinois, since 1949, and we dissect the precipitable water climatologies, the amount of water in the vertical atmosphere that could precipitate out, and we find that on the upper chart here, all of the spikes, most all of those have been measured in the last two decades. So for any individual date on the calendar, the maximum precipitable water measurement for that date over that point on the landscape has been measured in the last two decades. This is a pretty disturbing trend. There it is for MPX. There it is for the Twin Cities Radiosonde Station since 1948. And I already alluded to yesterday's measurement, radiosonde measurement at MPX was the second highest precipitable water measurement in the month of November in history. And so we see that indeed something is changing in the structure of the atmosphere over us that is dynamically producing these changes in the nature and quantity of precipitation that we're getting in some of these landscapes. So here's our 2014 National Weather Service Severe Storms Lab reports of severe weather across the nation. Prolific over the upper Mississippi Basin, always has been, but perhaps maybe growing in frequency. Another dissection of the data that might be of interest to you is the analysis of what we call the severe megastorms. The megastorms, by definition, are a 6-inch thunderstorm rain that encompasses at least 1,000 square miles of landscape, so a very large footprint of that storm, with a central core value of at least 8 inches. In the first 140 years of Minnesota weather history, we had 7 such animals exist in our history. Since the new millennium, we've had 5 more. Since the new millennium started, we've had 5 more. 7 in the first 140 years. Since the new millennium, we've had 5 more. Very destructive. Extremely destructive, extremely damaging. There's map depictions of the 5 that have occurred in the new millennium. These are the 13-inch, 15-inch, 17-inch rains that have occurred across portions of the landscape. Very, very devastating indeed. So, finally, what do we have to say about we see the evidence. The evidence really stares us in the face, as I've said many times. This is evidence. This is data that we cannot ignore. Again, I want to be careful about this. I'm framing the data in approximately a 160-year time frame. We are going through a period where year by year, decade by decade, we are more often observing something that we cannot find a measured historical analogy for. We're sampling something that we can't find a historical analogy for. So we're breaking individual records. We're seeing different patterns prevail. We're seeing all kinds of things in the data that jump out at us. And then we're relating those to observed consequences, and some of which include longer growing seasons and shifts in crop production systems, adjustments in monitoring plant diseases and insect infestations, because we're opening up more opportunities for invasion or hosting different species than would existed here before. So I would remind you of the northern migration of Asian soybean rust. It's not that many years ago that Asian soybean rust was even introduced to this country. But year by year, season by season, it's migrated to more northerly latitudes. It's found hosts, it's found ways to survive in higher latitude positions. Adjustments to amplified variation in extremes of hydrologic attributes, including redesign retrofits of storm sewer runoff systems, irrigation and drainage systems, shoreline management, and all kinds of mitigation projects related to watershed floods. We still have a lot of that going on. We have probably more than you could probably teach a whole semester course in this area when it comes to flood mitigation. Adjustments in public health relative to the changes in heat wave frequencies and also in livestock management. We've had individual years in the upper Mississippi Basin that were quite devastating to the livestock industries. 1995, 1999, 2001, 2006, to name just 4, where high mortality rates were induced by heat waves, all of which were brought on by high dew point or water vapor conditions. Not because the thermometer was spiking at 110 or 114 as it once did a long, long time ago, but because the dew points were so high and persisted for so many days. Also, modifications and adjustments to crop insurance. The crop insurance industry has been very much transformed in the last 2 decades. And much of that has been about trying to come up with better instruments to cope with the erratic, highly variable weather and what is brought on from the standpoint of risk management. And then strategies and response protocols for drought. In fact, there was just a huge regional drought conference here last week that we hosted in Minnesota that is becoming more and more prevalent because of the nature of this character change in precipitation that either gives great abundance to some areas or totally leaves out other areas. And I don't think that's suddenly going to go away. I think most are agreed that that is a pattern we're probably locked into as we migrate into the future. So I think that brings me to the end of my remarks, except I always like to show my Cloud Appreciation Society a photo at the end because I'm a proud member of the Cloud Appreciation Society. You can see any kind of cloud form that you want to see in this region of the country. So we're blessed in that regard for those of us that like to cloud spot. But I also put this out as a general statement. I strongly believe it. The data indicate climate change is happening. It's already producing consequences. We don't need a model to tell us that. It's right there in the data. It's right there in what we observe day to day in the landscape around us. It's right in our own backyard. And it's extremely poor judgment to ignore this. And that's the bottom line. So if anybody wants to ask a question, do we have time, Dawn?
I'm
going
to wait until the panel discussion.
Okay, that's fine.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay, thank you very much.